Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Census Data, County Residents Slow to Respond, by Caitlin Randall. U.S. Census data shows an average 43.3% self-response for Midland County residents living outside city limits. The self-response rate in the city of Midland was 54.6% as of Tuesday. Charlene Romero McBride, a senior partnership specialist with the U.S. Census Bureau, told county commissioners on Tuesday she believes the coronavirus pandemic has contributed to the low reporting numbers. COVID-19 has really put a strain on the census, she said during Tuesday's commissioner's court meeting. Many of the pockets with the lowest numbers of residents self-reporting are outside city limits, according to data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau through its Hard to Count Map initiative, which provides data on self-reporting nationwide. A tract near Midland Industrial Park has the fewest residents in Midland County who have completed their census questionnaires, with 24.7% of residents there having self-reported. Census data estimates 2,500 people lived in this tract between 2014 and 2018. The next lowest reporting area is near Sandy Acres, in a tract where 33% of residents have self-reported. The Bureau has extended its deadline for collecting census data because of a delay in going door-to-door caused by the pandemic. McBride said the new deadline for field data collection was extended 120 days to October 31st. One anticipated challenge in collecting census information for Midland County appears to have been partially alleviated because of layoffs associated with the pandemic. Though the Bureau initially believed they would be understaffed for census counters, a jump in unemployment has now made it likely there will be enough applicants, McBride said. She said they are still hiring for a six-week period at $24.50 an hour. McBride said her staff in Midland County are looking at creative ways to encourage residents to complete their questionnaires. In a tract near Northgate, with about 3,300 residents expected to be living there, only 38% have self-reported their information. McBride said this area is largely made up of apartment complexes, and her staff was planning a Chalk It Up campaign, in which they would ask children in these complexes to create chalk drawings on the sidewalks to encourage residents to fill out their responses. The Bureau is also concerned about young children being undercounted, McBride said. For children under the age of 5 in one tract south of Midland, the risk of being undercounted is very high, according to the Hard to Count map. An estimated 955 children under age 5 are believed to live in this tract, about 16% of the total estimated population for that area. Some of the reasons children are at risk of being undercounted in this tract is that 34% of children under age 5 live in families below the poverty level, and 40% of people living in renter-occupied housing, according to the hard-to-count data. McBride said her office would be introducing competitions at schools in areas where children risk being undercounted to encourage parents to participate in census data collections. A challenge with census counting that has been exacerbated by the pandemic is counting of individuals living in man camps. County Judge Terry Johnson said during Tuesday's commissioners' meeting that these group housing units were clearing out after widespread layoffs in the oil industry. Those who were living in man camps at the start of the pandemic were not counted by door-to-door census counters, McBride said. The time frame for counting individuals in these units was pushed back and will now take place from July 1st to September 3rd. The city of Midland is on par with Texas for self-reporting. 54.8% of Texans have self-reported, according to census data. Nationally, 60.1% of people have completed their census information. This article is entitled, Failure of Older Pipe Forces Rehab at Midkiff Golf Course Intersection, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council on Tuesday approved $850,000 emergency funding for pavement work at the intersection of Golf Course and Midkiff Roads. The funding came from a balance in an old street improvement fund. It is part of the overall cost that comes with replacing old, damaged infrastructure in some parts of Midland. Estimates are that the cost of replacing stormwater, sewer, water, and other infrastructure below the road, along with the roadway improvements, can run about $1.5 million. The city replaced a section of road and 200 feet of underground pipe just south of that intersection 2 years ago, Jose Ortiz, Director for Engineering Services, told the Midland Reporter-Telegram after meeting that the corrugated metal pipe, CMP, in that area was installed around 1971. He said there are about 10 miles of stormwater CMP that needs replacing in older parts of Midland. That is around 1/6 of the total stormwater pipe in Midland. He said the underground infrastructure that eventually failed at Golf Course in Midkiff had remained in place beyond its expected life and was on bonus time. He also said there are multiple examples of CMP failures around Midland from the last 2 years. Ortiz said expects to present a plan this summer in order to start replacing older pipelines before more damage can occur. He also said the city has started replacing older water and sewer lines during road projects, including those from the multi-year road bond. It gets expensive when we are reactive, Ortiz said. Being proactive will satisfy city leaders such as Councilman Lori Blong, who during the meeting specifically asked about the proactive steps city staff is taking to avoid situations as the unexpected reconstruction of intersections and roadways. Councilman Jack Ladd Jr., who represents Central Midland, said during the meeting Tuesday that he is getting more emails about the Midkiff and Golf Course intersection than any issue right now. We won't have to touch that intersection for decades, said Ortiz, who added the city recently put in place a drainage fee that will help pay for from future improvements. This article is entitled Coronavirus Roundup. City confirms 125th case from staff reports. The City of Midland Health Department is currently conducting its investigation on one new confirmed case of COVID-19 in Midland County, bringing the overall case count to 125. The 125th confirmed case is a female in her 90s who was tested by Midland Health. She is a resident at Midland Medical Lodge and is currently an inpatient at Midland Memorial Hospital. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. She is the 45th resident of Midland Medical Lodge to test positive. The woman is one of 24 people 80 or older that has tested positive for coronavirus, according to Midland Health Department. That is the most of any age range in Midland. Of the 125 cases in Midland County, 44 have recovered, according to the Health Department. The Health Department will continue to monitor the individual in accordance with the CDC. Crane County reports two nursing home deaths. Two residents at a Crane nursing home have died from coronavirus, according to a press release from Crane County. One died Tuesday morning. The release didn't state when the first resident died. Five employees and 16 residents at Focus Care Center tested positive for coronavirus last week, according to an earlier release. One resident had been transported to Odessa Regional Medical Center, but the release didn't specify if this was the second resident who died. Odessa Fire Rescue tested the residents and employees. Ector County confirms 16 more cases. Ector County confirmed 16 more positive cases of coronavirus since Friday, making the total 152. ECHD reported a fifth Ector County resident had died from coronavirus. Ector County Commissioner Eddie Shelton said two patients at Odessa Regional Hospital died from coronavirus. A 79-year-old Odessa man died Monday night, and a 75-year-old Crane nursing home resident died Tuesday morning.
Hector County reported 3 probable cases at this time, according to the ECHD website. ECHD reported that 99 people have recovered. There have been 2,366 tests taken, with 2,094 negative results and 120 pending results. ECHD has contacted 1,767 people during contact tracing. The drive-through site at the Ector County Coliseum positive case count remains at 13. Of the 171 tests done, 142 are negative and 16 are pending. In Ector County, 366 people have called the triage center for testing. Medical Center Health System President and CEO Russell Tippin said MCH is treating 7 positive patients. 4 patients are on the isolation floor, 3 patients are in critical care. 2 of them are on ventilators. MCH has tested 97 positive patients. Of those, 15 are from the Focused Care Center in Crane. In all, MCH has tested 1,228 people, with 1,107 in negative tests and 24 pending. ORMC CEO and President Stacy Brown said ORMC is treating 1 confirmed patient in critical care. 2 patients are under investigation. No patients are on the ventilator. ORMC has tested 17 positive cases, with 415 people tested. They have received 377 negative results, and 11 results are still pending. This is the section local and state. This article is entitled Midland ISD Releases Survey About School Calendar. District Collects Information on Parent-Teacher Needs by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD has released a survey to parents and teachers that includes questions about benefits and drawbacks of the current and alternative school district calendars. District leaders said during their last board meeting that staff needed to gain input from parents and teachers about an alternative calendar that Superintendent Orlando Riddick and his staff are promoting. The alternative calendar has an earlier start date, later end date, and allows for multiple weeks off in October and for spring break, along with traditional time off for Thanksgiving and Christmas. The Midland ISD board earlier in the spring approved the current calendar that's in place, but staff again made a presentation for the alternative calendar during the May board meeting. District officials have said that the decision about a new calendar could be made in mid-June, and that means teachers would have just more than a month before reporting to school on July 27th. The alternative calendar calls for a first day of school on August 3rd, compared to the current school-approved board date of August 19th. The survey asked parents and teachers about advantages and drawbacks for each calendar, and then if the person agrees or disagrees about whether the respective calendar affords students with the greatest instructional opportunities. There is no question that asks whether a parent or teacher prefers one calendar over the other. Parent and teacher feedback is critical in determining the benefits and drawbacks of an alternative calendar, Midland ISD stated in a press release. Parents also are asked about the number of personal electronic devices, computer, laptop, iPad, and tablet, in a household, optimizing a student's learning experience virtually. Challenges having to do with the virtual learning experience, the student's primary caregiver, social-emotional support needs, medical concerns, educational needs, and extracurricular activities. The questions about the calendar are at the end of the survey. In a press release, the district states it is seeking more information from parents and teachers about ways virtual learning can continue as an option for families. Input from families and staff is crucial in shaping what new learning models could look like, Riddick said in the release. However, we can't create an effective model without your feedback on what supports are needed. Please take the survey and make your voice heard. Responses are being collected until Tuesday. This is the opinion page. This column is called Opinion Extra. It's entitled, Will COVID-19 Disrupt Another Year? By Cynthia M. Allen, Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Last week, our family gathered around the computer to watch our eldest daughter graduate from preschool. It was the bittersweet and well-intentioned culmination of her school's effort to keep students connected after an abrupt and disappointing end to the semester. Her teacher cried, and after my daughter realized, for perhaps the first time since this whole thing started, that she wouldn't be returning to her classroom and her classmates, she did too. Our anticlimactic end to the school year was not unique. Children everywhere are closing out the academic year virtually, graduating online, saying goodbye to friends and teachers with the same energy as astronauts waving from outer space. So close, and yet so far. Meanwhile, parents everywhere have become a de facto educators, and reluctant homeschoolers are breathing a sigh of relief. Glad that it's over. But is it? Because there is good reason to believe that the next school year is going to be equally challenging when it could be more normal. In Texas, for example, Governor Greg Abbott last week announced that schools may reopen campuses for in-person summer school beginning June 1st, providing that safety protocols such as social distancing and temperature checks are followed. The relative success or failure of schools to prevent outbreaks this summer will inform how districts proceed come the fall, when local leaders will decide what the new academic experience looks like. To that end, the Centers for Disease Control have put forth guidelines for schools reopening, which herald an academic year of great tumult for parents and children, and a possible return to online learning at some point. Some of the CDC guidance is benign, such as reinforcing good hand hygiene, easier said than done with kindergartners, and encouraging staff and students to stay home when exhibiting symptoms of COVID-19 or other ailments. But there are suggestions that seem downright dystopian. Frequent health checks, cloth face coverings for children over 2 years of age, closing dining halls and playgrounds, an end to field trips, separated desks, plastic screens between bathroom sinks, and hallways with single-direction traffic and papered with signs reminding kids to stay 6 feet apart. Never mind that these precautions will be challenging, if not impossible, to enforce. They will create an environment of fear, especially for young children and those with special needs. Speaking of fear, the CDC guidance recommends that to avoid the ever-present concern of outbreak, each COVID-19 case in a school should result in dismissal for 2 to 5 days. Of course, that would disrupt academic and social development and create the same childcare concerns that have plagued many families this spring, especially since more people should be working in the fall. And how many interruptions can a school or district reasonably sustain before reverting to online learning for the remainder of the year? Then we're back to where we started. As demanding as online learning has been for many families, some will choose to homeschool to avoid either the disease or the inevitable turbulence and troubling environment that awaits their children in the fall. And who would blame them? Some schools in other nations have reopened, some never closed. Either way, they will provide a lot of good information about how U.S. schools can reopen successfully, and we should do everything possible to learn from those experiences. Like the hopeful research that suggests kids are not the vectors for COVID-19 we once assumed. For reasons scientists can't yet explain, it appears that children are less likely to transmit the virus than adults. Those that do get the virus, the rare but concerning and possibly related cases of multi-system inflammatory syndrome notwithstanding, generally experience with mild symptoms and recover quickly. If those trends hold, schools may actually be able to operate closer to normal than we thought. Wouldn't that be something? Because no one wants online preschool graduations to become the norm. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, May 27, 2020. Anne Lamarckant Newman, Anne Lamarcan Newman, 73, most recently of Abilene, passed away at her home on Friday, May 22, 2020. She was born in Midland, Texas on November 9, 1946 to Edward and Winona Lamarcan. Memorial services will be held at 2 p.m. on Friday, May 29th at Hamel Family Funeral Home, 6449 Buffalo Gap Road in Abilene. Officiated by Stan Alcorn of Pioneer Drive Baptist Church in Abilene. Bobby Dow Lanier. Bobby Dow Lanier, 73, joined his parents, friends, cousins, and other family members on May 23, 2020 after a long battle with prostate cancer. Bob is survived by his wife of 49 years, Karen, his daughter Whitney Blake Lanier Groves and her husband Kyle Groves, grandsons Andrew Tyler Groves and Parker Brandon Parker Groves, his mother-in-law Betty Duval and brother-in-law Dean Duval, his aunt Donna Lanier, and 16 cousins. He was preceded in death by his parents and grandparents, father-in-law Bud Duval, cousins Jerry Lanier and Merle Parsons, most of his aunts and uncles, and friends John Hart, James Lyon, Gary Van Antwerp, Alan Wallace, Don Green, and his lifelong partner in crime, Terry Pritchett. Although we are heartbroken, we know there is no more pain, and he is with so many loved ones who welcomed him home. Celebrations of life will be held later in Midland and in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Donations may be made to the Potawatomi Historical Society Museum, 614 East Main Street, Shawnee, Oklahoma, 74801, for the Lanier Family Library in honor of Bob. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelsh.com. Carlton Proctor. Carlton Proctor, 52, of Midland, passed away May 23, 2020, following a long illness. A memorial service will be scheduled at a later date. Carlton was born on October 14, 1967, in Midland, Texas, to Leo and Juanita Proctor. He worked in construction since he was a teenager and was a voluntary firefighter in the Metroplex. He is preceded in death by his mother, Juanita Wilson Proctor, and nephew Tyler Norman. The family would like to thank all the healthcare workers at Midland Memorial Hospital and Hospice of Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Ellis Funeral Home of Midland. Grace Pineda Cano. Grace Pineda Cano was born October 5, 1964 in Odessa, Texas, and passed away unexpectedly on Friday, May 22, 2020, at the age of 55. Grace grew up in South Odessa alongside her siblings and cousins. She was a youth athlete that played baseball and went on to play recreational softball as an adult. Grace is survived by her mother, Elisa Ivaro, her daughters, Kathy Lopez and Lisa Hernandez, her sons, Emilio Cano and Vicente Cano, her companion, Frank Cano, her grandchildren, Michael, Melanie, Matthew, Madison, Beto, Kennedy, and Eli. Her brothers Mark Ivaro and Eric Ivaro, her sisters Elva, Anaya, and Michelle Ontiveros, and numerous aunts, nieces, nephews, cousins, and friends. She is preceded in death by her brother Raymond Pineda. A viewing will be held on Thursday, May 28th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, located at 1502 North La Mesa Road, Midland. Family and friends are expected to pay their respects during this time. Please note masks must be worn. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Ernie Caraballo. Ernie Caraballo, 61, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, May 21, 2020, in Midland, Texas. Ernie was born on April 2, 1959, to Mitsuko and Ernesto Caraballo in Brooklyn, New York. A memorial service will be held on Thursday, May 28 at 2 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery, Funeral Home, and Crematory. Bethany Sue Waterman Polly. Bethany Sue Waterman Polly, 56, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, May 23, 2020, in Midland, Texas. Bethany was born July 1, 1963, to Doris and Norman Waterman in Lansing, Michigan. No services are scheduled at this time. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. Robert Garza Hernandez. Robert Garza Hernandez, 57, of Midland, passed away Tuesday, May 19, 2020. Visitation will be held on Tuesday, May 26, 2020, from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. Funeral services will be conducted on Wednesday, May 27th at 10 a.m. with Pastor Ed Mayberry officiating. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. He is survived by his son, Robert James Hernandez, his daughter, April Renee Hernandez, his father, Felix G. Hernandez. Vicki Jean Slatten. Vicki Jean Slatten, 58, of Midland, passed away Saturday, May 22nd at Midland Memorial Hospital. She was born September 19, 1961, in Midland. Memorial services will be held privately by the family.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, May 27th. Fifth death reported in Ector County. Two Crane nursing home residents die. The story was written by Michael Merlo. As COVID-19 numbers continue to rise in the Permian Basin, Ector County officials reported two new virus-related deaths in county hospitals. An Ector County release detailed that two COVID-19 patients died at Odessa Regional Medical Center, one on Monday night and the other on Tuesday morning. One of the patients was a 79-year-old man from Odessa, while the other was reported by the health department as a 75-year-old man from Crane County who was a resident at Focus Care at Crane Nursing Home. An Odessa Fire Rescue COVID-19 testing revealed on Friday that 16 Focus Care at Crane residents tested positive, along with 5 employees. Rebecca Reed, who handles communications for Focus Care, reported that two of the Crane nursing home residents have died, one from Ector County and one from Midland County. One of the residents died at ORMC, and the other died in the nursing home Monday night. She wrote in a text message that Tuesday, one more resident is being admitted to an Ector County hospital. Reed said that some employee tests are still pending. She added that team members are in regular contact with the medical director, who determines whether a resident should be admitted for inpatient care, and that certain wings of the facility are blocked off for isolation. Ector County has 152 positive cases, 48 active, 99 recovered, and 5 deaths. The Ector County Coliseum drive-thru testing numbers detail 13 positives, 16 pending, and 142 negatives. Out of 366 calls received, 177 people have been tested. Since May 17th to May 26th, there have been 38 new cases due to social gatherings, a county release detailed. Medical Center Hospital President and CEO Russell Tippin reported that they've had 97 positives and 15 of those came back from the Crane Nursing Home. 7 positives are in the hospital, 3 on the critical care unit, 2 of which are on ventilators. None of the patients in-house are from the Crane Nursing Home, a press release detailed. Medical Center Hospital reported 1,107 negatives, which includes 64 negatives from the Crane Nursing Home. Tippin said that Medical Center Hospital will not change their visitor policy as the result of increasing positive cases. Odessa Regional Medical Center President Stacy Brown reported that out of 405 tests, 17 have been positive, 377 have been negative, and 11 are pending. She added, two persons under investigation are in the hospital, and one positive is in the ICU. ORMC Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohith Saravanan said, quote, "It is not now speculation anymore that the cases are rising or could rise. They are rising, so we need to do something about it to make sure that we can control the rise. Otherwise, we're going to end up having a rapid rise and a peak that we may not be anticipating," end quote. He added that ORMC also will hold off on opening up visitor protocol. Over the weekend, Focus Scare's corporate office responded in a lengthy press release to Crane County Judge Roy Hodges' comments regarding a lack of communication between the Crane Nursing Home and Crane's elected officials and health department. The release details that Focus Care has an emphasis on the corporation's transparency, candor, and integrity, while listing other actions they reported having taken before and during the pandemic. Hodges did not return phone calls in reference to Focus Care's response.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing with one more front page article from the Odessa American, Wednesday, May 27th. County dreads 2020-2021 budget writing. Coliseum to reopen with stringent screening, by Bob Campbell. Ector County Commissioners Tuesday thanked assembled county department heads for making deep cuts in their budgets and warned them that writing the 2020-2021 budget will be even tougher in light of COVID-19-related revenue losses. County Judge Debbie Hayes said the court had wanted the heads to take a real hard look at your budgets and try to reduce by 30%, explaining that money and supplies saved before the fiscal year ends September 30th will make managing next year easier. "It's sad because we already had a downturn with the energy industry before COVID," Hayes said. She said the court expects a resurgence of the pandemic next winter. "I ask that you be that leader for yourselves, your employees, the court, and the community," the judge said near the end of the two-hour session. Precinct 3 Commissioner Dale Childers said the commissioners don't look forward to the first week in August because that's when that budget writing process will start. "I think all we'll be able to do is keep our heads above water," Childers said. He said some department heads were able to make 30% cuts and some weren't, but they all made a sincere effort. In other business, the commissioners heard Coliseum manager Aaron Martin propose that the Coliseum be reopened in accordance with state COVID-19 guidelines in time for a June 13th gun show, an arts and crafts show a month later, and other events that will start revenues flowing again. The court voted in Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons' absence to consider Martin's request after he includes the County Health Department in his preparations. Health Department Director Brandy Garcia said it is a great idea for us to look at those events. And Dr. B.A. Janadu, the local health authority who works with Garcia, said care should be taken to screen participants from COVID hotspots in other parts of Texas. Garcia said 36 people got coronavirus here last week, and two, both men, had died Monday night and Tuesday morning. Auditor Randy Donner won approval of a grant application for $2.6 million from the Social Security Administration to help battle COVID with 20%, or $520,000, to be received immediately. Precinct 4 Commissioner Armando Rodriguez expressed an urgent concern that Hispanics, who make up some 78% of Ector County's population and have constituted about that percentage of the local citizens who have contracted coronavirus and are particularly vulnerable because they tend to gather in large groups and miss English language warnings. Rodriguez said Spanish language radio announcements would be most effective in spreading the word, and the court agreed to intensify such efforts, working with the media and the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Hearing Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance Vice President Dustin Fawcett's report on Interstate 27 studies, the court passed a resolution backing MoTrans' preference for a western route to bring the interstate through the Permian Basin, opposing the so-called eastern route through Big Spring. Fawcett said the western option is only one that makes sense, given the basin's economic importance. The court also approved an amended notice moving the Democratic and Republican primary runoffs from May 26th to July 14th and doubling the length of the early voting period by starting it on June 29th instead of July 6th. Okayed 67th Street improvements to include an extension to U.S. 385, resolving drainage issues, and authorized paying Landgraf Crutcher Associates $68,250 to design improvements of Redondo Avenue between 16th Street and University Boulevard. Designated Dr. Timothy Benton to serve as the acting local health authority in the absence of Janadu. Okayed the county's vendor food services contract with Summit Foods for the rest of this fiscal year and extended the agreement for in-house meals preparation for seniors into 2020-2021. Approved a $1,750,000 contract services amendment for the detention center expansion. Hired a water quality specialist for the health department.
COVID-19 news. By the numbers, Ector County confirmed cases, 152. Ector County negative, 2,094 out of 2,366 tested, with 120 pending. 5 deaths. Midland County, 125 confirmed cases out of 2,686 tested. 12 deaths. Texas, 56,560 confirmed cases with 943,239 tested. Total Texas deaths, 1,536. U.S. cases, 1,662,414 total confirmed cases and 98,261 deaths. Find out more online at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site. The 6th annual Just-in-Time Cook-Off benefit for the Wounded Warrior Project has been scheduled Friday and Saturday in Wink. On Friday, Chili Cook-Off and Kids Q Steak Cook-Off. On Saturday, Barbecue Cook-Off, Awards, 50-50 Raffle, Drawing, Vendors, and more. Entertainment will be presented by the State Line Band. Sponsorship, tax-deductible, is available. Volunteers are also needed. For more information, call 432-940-2874 or 448-8213. Girls World Expo is a day-long event created by local teen girls for local teen girls who have created a unique show from noon to 4 p.m. June 20th at the Midland County Horseshoe, 2514 Arena Trail, Midland. The event will include seminars, fashion, an art show, performances, demonstrations, vendors, and more. Volunteer opportunities are available. Email Mary at girlsworldexpo.com or visit girlsworldexpo.com. The 8th Annual West Texas Boulevard Nights Car Show has been scheduled from noon to 8 p.m. July 28th at the Midland County Horseshoe Arena Pavilion at 2514 Arena Trail in Midland. There will be a pin-up contest, live concerts, live DJ battle, car hop, tattoo booth, vendors and food trucks, custom cars, trucks, lowriders, classics, motorcycles, bikes, and more. For more information, call 202-1234 or 664-2766.
From the Inside Pages. Man charged with sexually assaulting 15-year-old. An Ector County Sheriff's Office affidavit detailed a 35-year-old man sexually assaulted a 15-year-old boy after they met on Grindr. Esteban Valdevez Jr., 35, was charged with sexual assault of a child, a second-degree felony. At around 1:23 a.m. Monday, ECSO was advised of a possible sexual assault at the Road Ranger located at 10490 West Interstate 20, the affidavit detailed. The victim's mother reportedly told deputies that her 15-year-old son had taken off with a man in an 18-wheeler who was later identified as Valdevez. Investigation showed that while the 15-year-old was with Valdevez, that the 35-year-old man had sexually assaulted him, the affidavit stated. The 15-year-old was given a forensic interview where he stated he had known Valdevez since the end of February after he met him on Grindr. The boy said during the time he and Valdevez had known each other, they had had sexual intercourse twice. The 15-year-old stated the first time they had sexual intercourse was 2 weeks after meeting, which was sometime in March, at Valdevez's RV, the affidavit stated. He stated the second time they had intercourse was on Monday in the parking lot of Murray Fly Elementary School while in the bed of Valdevez's 18-wheeler. Valdevez was reportedly contacted at the ECSO where he stated he was with a male subject he had met on Tinder, but declined to provide any further information. Valdevez was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. He had won bond totaling $20,000 and posted bail on Tuesday. Jail records show.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. Man charged with pointing BB gun at occupied vehicles. An Odessa Police Department affidavit detailed a 42-year-old man pointed a gun, which turned out to be a BB gun, at passing vehicles near Walmart on 42nd Street. Jerry Wayne Beeson was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony. The reported assault happened around 9:23 a.m. Friday near the area of Chili's located at 5025 East 42nd Street, an OPD affidavit stated. Dispatch stated they received multiple calls about a man wearing a green hat, green shirt, and jeans who was pointing a gun at passing vehicles. When officers arrived at the scene, they reportedly saw a man, matching the description, standing at the northeast corner of the intersection of 42nd Street and JBS Parkway. The man had a black, unidentified object in his hand. Officers approached the man, who was later identified as Beeson, and ordered him to show his hands while Beeson was being held at gunpoint. Beeson dropped the object in his hand, which was a rolled up rag, and put his hands in the air. Beeson had a pistol grip tucked into his waistband. He was reportedly ordered not to reach for anything and then pulled the gun out from his waistband and dropped it to the ground. The gun was a BB gun. A witness stated Beeson had pointed the gun directly at her while sitting in her car at the south exit from the Walmart parking lot, the affidavit stated. The witness also stated they witnessed Beeson point the gun at multiple other people and occupied vehicles. Beeson was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. He had won bond totaling $25,000 and was still in custody as of Tuesday afternoon, jail records show. Man charged in wooden cane assault. A 54-year-old man was arrested after he reportedly assaulted another man with a wooden cane and threatened to stab him with a knife. Philip Ray Lindquist was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony. He was additionally charged with possession of marijuana, a Class B misdemeanor. The reported assault happened May 19th in the 300 West 5th Street block, an Odessa Police Department affidavit stated. The victim, who was identified as Thomas Stark, reportedly told officers that Lindquist assaulted him with a wooden cane. Stark stated the cane broke after he was struck in the ribs. Stark also stated after he was struck with the wooden cane, Lindquist showed a knife and reportedly said he would gut him. The reporting officer saw several injuries to Stark that were consistent with his statement. The reporting officer also stated he saw the broken wooden cane used to assault Stark. A witness, identified as Leonard Daniels, reportedly confirmed that he knew Lindquist. Daniels reportedly told the officer he saw Lindquist assault Stark with the cane, show a knife, and make threats to stab Stark. Lindquist was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. He has two bonds totaling $25,500 and was still in custody as of Tuesday morning, jail records show. Obituaries for Wednesday, May 27th. Julia Hernandez Hill. Julia Hernandez Hill, 92, of Odessa, passed away Friday, May 22nd at Siena Nursing Home. She was born April 12th, 1928 in Terlingua to the late Francisca Cervantes and Tomas Hernandez. She married David Hill in 1953 in Odessa. Julia is survived by her sons, Reuben Hill of Mulcateo, Washington, Robert Hill and wife Mary of Mansfield, and Israel Hill and wife Raquel of Grand Prairie, daughters Delma Hill Grado and husband Rodolfo, and Dolores Rodriguez and husband Miguel, all of Odessa, brothers Faustino Hernandez, Bill Milan and wife Gloria, and Tony Gaspar and wife Carol, sisters Modesta Lujan and husband Mike, Ida Hernandez and Esperanza Hernandez, 13 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her husband, David O. Hill, brothers Isaac, Ippolito, Mario, Jose Pepe, and Sebastian Hernandez, sister Maria Hernandez, and sister-in-law Agapita Hernandez. Visitation will be Wednesday, May 27th from noon till 9 p.m. at Odessa Funeral Home, with rosary being recited at 7 p.m. A mass of Christian burial will be celebrated privately for the family by Father Frank Chavez Thursday, May 28th at St. Anthony Catholic Church. Burial will be at the Rose Hill section of Ector County Cemetery. Please visit odessafuneralhome.com to leave online condolences. Tanya LeJan Moore. Fayetteville, Arkansas. Tanya was born in Hobbs, New Mexico, September 21, 1950, to Wilma Deweese Dusek and Ronald Moore, and passed away May 22nd. She is survived by her mother, Wilma, and stepfather, Benny, brother and sisters, Ronnie, Lori, and Baxter. Her children, Shannon Dwayne Berry, Kenny Lee Berry, Tamala Jean Sanders, Jessica Lorette Royal and husband Berry, and Brandon Earl Tyler. 10 grandchildren, and several great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. She is preceded in death by her father, J.E. Turner, her daughter, Tamala Sanders, and her son, Shannon Berry. Visitation will be Sunday, May 31st, from 2 to 6 p.m. at Odessa Funeral Home. Funeral services will be Monday, June 1st, at 10 a.m. at Odessa Funeral Home Chapel, followed by burial at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Zanna O'Neill Fryman. Zanna O'Neill Fryman, 65, of Odessa, passed away May 25th in Lubbock. She was born in Odessa to Harvey and Catherine O'Neill, August 19, 1954. She married Carl Fryman in 1994 in Las Vegas, Nevada. Zanna is preceded in death by her parents, Harvey and Catherine O'Neill. She is survived by her husband, Carl Fryman, son Chris and wife Maritza Golden, Ryan and Sybil Golden, brothers Bob O'Neill and J.D. O'Neill, and six grandchildren. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home, and you can sign the guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Charles A. Berlin. Charles A. Berlin, 82, passed away Friday, May 22nd. He was born January 18, 1938, in Aledo to Charles Alfred Berlin and Lula Ball Berlin. He is survived by his wife, Harriet Mitchell Berlin of Odessa, brother Robert Reed Berlin of Odessa, his children, Charles Allen Berlin and William Burns of Castroville, Daryl and Janella Berlin of Odessa, Carol and Robert Stein of Houston, Robert and Sulio Berlin of Louisville, Kentucky. Six grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, and 3 great-great-grandchildren. Visitation will be Thursday, May 28th at Frank Wilson Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held Friday, May 29th at the Frank Wilson Chapel in Odessa. Death notices. Ramon H. Galindo. Ramon H. Galindo, 75, died Tuesday, May 26th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. John Larad. John Larad, 55, of Odessa, died Sunday, May 24th. A celebration of life is scheduled for 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Thursday, May 28th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Zachary Scott Weatherman. Zachary Scott Weatherman, 23, of Farmersville, died Thursday, May 21st in Odessa. A funeral service is scheduled for 1 p.m. Thursday, May 28th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Interment will follow at Sunset Memorial Garden Cemetery. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Tattoos and pacemakers. Dear Dr. Roach, this might be a frivolous question, but is it safe to get a tattoo if I have a pacemaker? I have been told it is not safe, but I don't think much research has been done. Your answer could save people from a needless risk. SB. Answer. I don't think it is frivolous at all. Many people are getting tattoos, and considering the medical risks of a tattoo is important, especially in older adults and those with greater medical issues. When researching the answer, I found a lot of conflicting information. Because tattooing machines emit an electromagnetic field, there is a theoretical reason to be concerned. Strong magnetic fields turn pacemakers off by design. However, the field of a tattoo machine is not strong, and Medtronic, one of the largest pacemaker manufacturers, considers tattoo machines to be minimal risk. It recommends keeping the tattoo machine at least 6 inches away from the pacemaker. I read many reports of people getting tattoos right on top of the pacemaker without problems, but I would recommend being conservative. By contrast, an induction cooktop has a much stronger magnetic field and is a much higher risk. Medtronic recommends keeping a pacemaker 2 feet away. A microwave oven presents no danger at all to pacemaker function, presuming it is in good working condition. There are still some tattoos made by hand without a machine, especially in traditions from Japan and Hawaii. These would be safest from the standpoint of a pacemaker.
Dear Abby, for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. Serious health issues dominate 40-year marriage. Dear Abby, I married my husband 40 years ago. A few years later, he was diagnosed with diabetes. He refused to take care of himself and ended up with double leg amputations 13 years ago. He had prosthetics but wouldn't use them. I stood by him and was his advocate, but he blamed me. He now has major health issues, but I'm not too concerned. According to him, it's none of my business. Family doesn't care because he doesn't care. My daughter blames me, but she doesn't bother to have much contact with her father. I have had enough of trying to help a man who doesn't want help. This is a loveless marriage and has been for years. He also is addicted to computer porn. He stays at a computer for hours, even when people are around. He doesn't care who's around. He broke his computer recently, and I have refused to allow him on mine, so he is angry at me for that too. For most of our marriage, I have worked outside the home. I still do. I would rather be out of the house than here with a husband who doesn't care if I'm around or not. Please advise me what I can do. Reached the limit. Dear Reached, what you can do depends on what you want to do. There must be a reason why you have remained in this loveless marriage as long as you have. Since you asked, I do have a word of advice. Help your husband to get another computer. If you do, it may lessen some of the hostility that is ruling your household. He will be occupied, and you can do whatever you need to keep yourself sane. Dear Abby, my husband and I are dealing with a terminal health condition, and many folks have offered to help, particularly in the area of providing meals, which we really appreciate. Recently, a family from our church brought us over a meal that included a nice entree, dessert, bread, and breakfast pastries, all homemade. We enjoyed the entree, but quickly lost our appetites after opening the dessert to find a hair of unknown origin in it. We were unfortunately unable to enjoy the rest of the food because of this. My dilemma is how to handle this with the family. I'm sure we will see them at church, and they have already reached out asking when they can bring us another meal. I don't want to embarrass anyone, but neither do I think I can consume another one from them. For what it's worth, we have someone who comes in weekly who prepares meals for us, whom we pay. This has been a huge help because it alleviates the time and effort required to shop, cook, and clean up most of the work week because I work full-time as well as care for my husband. How can I tactfully decline this family's kind offers without coming right out and saying why we don't want their food? Grossed out in the West. Dear Grossed Out, it should not embarrass those nice people if you thank them for offering to send you more food and tell them you no longer need food because you have hired someone who comes in and cooks for you. It's short, sweet, and it's the truth. We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.